Welcome to a brand new Welsh Premier League podcast feature where we get to know some of the outstanding people that make this league what it is. Over the coming weeks and months, we'll be meeting and interviewing some of the key figures of Welsh Prem past and present to learn more about their journeys in the beautiful game. For this first one, we've gone all out, meeting up with one of the league's most successful managers, Craig Harrison, to talk about his experiences in football. It's a two-parter, and in this first instalment, we discuss his beginnings in football, the inspiration of Paul Gascoigne and getting to know his idol at Middlesbrough, as well as looking at key moments in this man's whirlwind of a playing career from start to finish. Enjoy! So, Craig, thank you so much for joining us for this. It's great to have you with us.
No problem.
I think everyone will know the headlines, you know, the numerous titles, the European journeys, and, you know, your Premier League experience and so on. But where did it all begin? Where does Craig Harrison, the footballer's journey, begin?
I think it's from being an early child. I think, you know, it's me dad loved football. My dad played non-league football, played Sunday morning football, went to watch him as probably 5, 6, 7 years old, and from then on, you know, he spent numerous hours with me at the park playing football as a real young child. You know, and from then on, I think it's just the love of football. Then, you know, we went to watch Newcastle before I was old enough to play. I think back then it was completely different. Back then it was, you know, now you've got kids being, you know, transferred at 6, 7, 8 years old, and every academy under the sun's wanting them. But I didn't. It was school was the first sort of organised 11-side football I played, and I couldn't. I must have been about 9, 10, I think it must have been. And then I played in the junior league, which was under 12s. It was my first sort of experience of junior football, and I was 9 at the time. You know, I had to change my registration because you weren't allowed to play unless you were over 10, but I was actually 9 at the time. But fortunately, my uncle and my dad run the football team, and I played in that at under 12s at 9 years old. And then from then on, it was just, you know, that journey of loving football and playing local football for boys clubs and, you know, school teams and counties and stuff like that. It wasn't what it is now, far from it. You know, I used to train twice a week in boys club, play for the school team, play for the boys club team, play for the two of the boys club team, a Saturday and a Sunday. So I'd be playing three games a week, every week, and training 4 or 5 times a week as well, which, you know, I wouldn't change for the world. I love it, you know, I loved it. It was, you know, and then the time that I wasn't training, I'd still go to the boys club, which was a boys club called Redruff Boys Club, where Paul Gascoigne come through, and Don Hutchison and I think Neil Aspin as well, and there was a few that come through that system and go there just to play football in the hall. You know, there'd be, you know, 15, 20 if we're playing football in a small hall with a sponge ball in just free-for-all. You know, but that was reflected in everyday life as well, regarding getting home from school, first thing you've done, right, get changed, I'm going to go out and play football. So whether it was on the local grass pitch or whether it was in the street against the wall, whatever it may be, it was just football. In, you know, could have played out there all night. And, you know, I think it's a bit, you see it now, don't you? And I personally think there's too much at a young age structured football for the young kids. You know, I think that you go back to it and you talk about street soccer, and, you know, where if there's 20 years, it's 10v10. If there's 30 years, it's 15v15. It's just, you know, it is what it is. You know, you have a little stint in goal, you play anywhere you want. You know, the big lads play with the little lads. If you're a little lad, you get kicked and you get on with it. And if you're a skillful player, you get kicked. And, you know, you just learn to compete at every level and every style and type of football. You know, so it's obviously very, very structured these days. You know, they go through a process and, you know, they're not supposed to play so many hours and this and that and the other, where I think it's good, because they're obviously getting very good professional coaching. You know, from me being a young lad, it was always parents who coached it, you know, which the enthusiasm and they'd done it for nothing and everything. But obviously now you've got licensed coaches. But I do think it's stifled a little bit of individual talent. And it's a lot more knowledge about football at a younger age, which I think, in a way, it's good, and then in another way, I think the innocence is sort of part of the process of just playing football.
And I mean, you look at some of the best players in the world nowadays, I guess, your Messi's, your Ronaldo's, your Neymar's and so on. If you asked them what their journey was, they'd probably say, you know, they were young kids playing against bigger kids and they were just, you know, they learned that way. So it does still happen in other parts of the world.
Yeah, it does. It's just really, really sad because you look at it and, you know, and I had a fantastic childhood. You know, I really did. I was very fortunate that my dad loved football and he would take us to the park and he would take us everywhere I needed to go to play football. And I had lots of friends that loved football. And, you know, I think the age group that I went through all the way through, I think there was probably six or seven end up going and playing professional football, and it was, you know, it was really good, and everyone wanted to play football, you know, and it wasn't, like I said, stifled or clinical like it is now, you know. But the world's changed, hasn't it? You see so many, you know, keep off the grass signs, no ball games, you know, goodness me, you know, the street where you lived in, you know, the person that lived on the end must have been going crazy, because, you know, you'd draw a goal on the end with chalk and you'd play and someone go and goal, or you'd go on one of the back lanes and use that as a goal, or you'd play up and down the back alley as, you know, 8v8, 9v9 kids screaming and shouting and running around celebrating, and, you know, no referees, and, you know, be like murder ball sometimes. But I think it just prepares you for football in, you know, at a higher level in a state of sort of the older you get, the more clinical it becomes, and it's something that I think it is dying without a shadow of a doubt, and I think it's up to us as coaches to possibly try and recreate that as much as what we can. Not all the time, because the good thing about coaching and more coaches and better coaches is as organisation and so on and so forth, but as in just let the younger players, you know, play. Mm-hmm. As long as no one gets hurt, then just let them work out sometimes the solutions for themselves.
Mm-hmm. And you had some fantastic inspiration, as you alluded to earlier, in terms of the players that were in the same club as you at one point. I mean, Paul Gascoigne, for me, unfortunately, I'm a bit too young to remember Gazza. Yeah. So if you had to pitch this player, who I think you've described as the best player ever to wear an English shirt.
Yeah, I personally think so, yeah. Still think that now.
And if you had to sort of explain what this person meant to you, how would you...
Well, it was a strange one, because he's I think Paul's 10 years older than me, but his pictures were up on the walls, you know, same as Don Hutchinson, about the same age, pictures up on the walls, team photographs. He would come back to the boys' club, which was a massive event. I think at the time he was at Lazio when he came back to the boys' club, you know, and it was just, you know, it was something that everyone looked up upon and gave everyone the opportunity to see this lad from very humble beginnings and, you know, and just explode on it. Being at one point in my mind, in the, I think it was the World Cup against Holland, he was the best player in the world, you know, my opinion, and he certainly was the best player that has ever played for England. Did he fulfil his full potential? Even then, probably not, because obviously it's well documented about the personal problems he's had, and he's had all his life, you know, and he's one that's not shied away from that. He's someone being open with it. But to have that type of footballer, watching Newcastle as a kid, Paul Gascoigne was playing in the team with Peter Beardsley, Chris Waddle. So they were people I looked up to. Then B, going to a boys' club that he played for. Then just to top it all off, in May, I think it was
debut season, wasn't it?
Two or three seasons he was actually a teammate. Mm. You know, and I played with him on numerous occasions, and, you know, and I was very, very fortunate to share lifts with him in and out, because obviously at the time he was living in Gateshead, coming back, I think, and spending time at his dad's, his family home, and then I was living in Durham and I was giving him a lift and so on here and there, and I was very, very, very fortunate to spend personal time and professional time with, like I said, for me the best natural talent, you know, England's ever had.
And I mean, obviously, you're a professional footballer at the time. You've got to do your job and so on. But you must be sitting there pinching yourself as well,
the whole thing for me sitting here now. It almost, you know, feels like it was somebody else. Hmm. You know, it was a different, obviously it was a long time ago anyway, but and a lot of things have gone on from then. I've actually been a manager longer than I was a professional first team player, but and I'm still only 40, so it's not, it's still one of them things that you think of and you think, wow, that no, did that really happen? But, you know, Brian Robson's another one. That was a big, you know, a big inspiration from the northeast, from Durham area, you know, England captain, Manchester United captain, come to Middlesbrough, and obviously he's your manager, and the players he brought in, even just the British players, you know, the likes of Andy Townsend, Paul Gascoigne, Paul Ince, Paul Merson, and then you've got the foreign lads, you know, Emerson, Janino, Ravanelli, and you know, it was just a surreal period to come through as a youngster in Middlesbrough, where there was the likes of myself, Andy Campbell, Robbie Stockdale, Mark Somerville, Ben Roberts, all come through and played quite an important part in over three or four seasons between the five of us.
And I mean, you mentioned playing under Robbo.
Yeah.
You've played under some of the good managers as well. And as you obviously came into management, what did you take from learning from those guys, do you think, and apply to your own style?
I think the biggest thing from Brian Robson was just his aura and his, you know, I think if he told you to, you know, run through a brick wall, you'd run through a brick wall. Whatever he said you would do, and I think that was probably as much as a respect thing as anything else, you know. And he had staff on at the time like Viv Anderson, Gordon McQueen, Dave Geddes, who has been a huge influence on my career. Dave Geddes, we're still friends now. Dave was my youth team coach from being, I think, my first time when I went to join the Middlesbrough Academy, but that was only at 15. You know, bearing in mind what happens now, they ain't at 9, 10 year old. I went there at 15. I went there the early part of my 15th birthday, and I was only there for 9 months, and I signed full time to be a YTS. So before that, I'd went to different clubs and had trials, but it wasn't 10, 11, 12 year old. It was like 13, 14, 15 then. I played right the way to my local boys club right until I was under 16s, and I was 15 at the time, and then I personally felt that was the best for me. You know, I thought I'd develop better there. You know, and I was a bit of a late developer really, because there was other players in and around us that were signing for Chelsea, Notts County, you know, other teams, and they were getting 2-3 year deals at 14, going through to be a YT. But in the end, it worked out that I was the only one that ever played in the first team regular. So I think I was a late developer, and I think what helped us was I stayed in the environment, i.e. my boys club, that I felt comfortable, I enjoyed, and I got the best out of me. And I dipped in and out of Middlesbrough Academy, but Dave Geddes was the first one. It was the School of Excellence then, which was a long time ago. It was one night a week, believe it or not. It was a Friday night at a local school in a gym, and that's all it was. Yeah. You know, and Dave was my coach, and then Dave moved on, and I moved on to being Dave was my youth team coach for 2 years, and Dave was my reserve team coach as well. So, you know, I owe a lot of certainly my early grounding, and a lot of probably my morals in football to Dave Geddes. You know, like I said, I speak to him still. You know, we've still got a great friendship, and you know, I spoke to him quite a bit when we're up in Hartlepool, because he's based up in Durham, and we spend time together, families, and you know, and Dave and his family are fantastic people. And I was very, very fortunate to have someone who'd been in the game, European Cup winner, FA Cup winner, Ipswich, Aston Villa, had a great career that I could class as a friend, and if I needed anything, you know, he was blunt and to the point, and gave us very, very good, you know, very good knowledge and advice on football.
And obviously you ended up at Crystal Palace. Turns out to have been a bit of a breeding ground for Welsh Premier League managers with Christian and Andy there as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? It's weird how things end up turning out. You know, I think I put a picture on Instagram when I first come into the club regarding being Andy's assistant. You know, we played together. You know, Christian as well played in that same team. I think Christian was on loan from Nottingham Forest, and Andy was on loan from Man City. You know, and it was it's quite strange and how things work themselves out. It's a strange, it's a weird way football's got twists and turns. I think I put it on my Instagram message. So yes, it's there has been. It was I loved my time at Crystal Palace. It was horrendous regarding obviously the injury that happened, but I think it was something that I needed to, you know, it was all very, very strange the way it happened. I'd obviously done well at Middlesbrough, played in the first team. I'd been had a loan spell at Preston under David Moyes, another fantastic manager. Then come back in, played in the Premier League. Then went, I think I had an injury. Didn't really play much after that. And then I think it was after that I went on loan. I can't remember the actual details of it. But I come back and I just thought in my head, I'm a professional footballer. I want to play football games. I don't want to be a sub. I don't want to be a squad player. As much as Brian Robson had said to me, I just signed a new 5-year contract. I think I was 7 or 8 months into a 5-year contract at 20 years old. But I'd had that feeling of playing in front of 25, 30, 35,000 people, that adrenaline you get in what you want to be as a footballer. As much as I possibly could have been a bit more patient, I just felt that I'm a footballer. I don't want to be one of these footballers that finished a career and have only played 100 games. Mm. You know, I'm there to play football. I wanted to play 200, 300, 400 games at whatever level it was. At the time, Brian Robson said to me, "You won't be number one," which is understandable. You know, Christian Ziga had just come in. You know, Dean Gordon was still at the football club. Keith O'Neill was still at the football club. So, but he said, you know, as a young player, you've done really well for us. You'll get your opportunity, but over the next season or so, you're going to have to be patient and wait. And it wasn't something that I was prepared to do, which, whether that sounds big-headed or whether that sounds impatient, I think it was more impatient. But I just think unless you've felt that adrenaline and almost the rush and the drug of playing in front of that many people, and then you go back down to playing reserve team football, which at the time was fantastic because it was an unwritten rule. If you didn't play on a Saturday, you'd be playing on a Wednesday night. So you get teams that had 5 or 6 first team players playing, which was a fantastic education from being 17 to 21. Not saying I was too good to play in that. It was just the highs of playing in the first team that I didn't want to go back to that, and I went to see. Brian Robson just said, "Look, I need to play first team football. You've said I'm not going to play here, straight up automatic choice. Could I go out on loan?" "Yes, no problem." Went out on loan, and then I'd done well for my first month or so at Crystal Palace, and it turned into a permanent move. Mm. But, you know, I think anyone listening to this interview who's played at a football club and been through a football club as a young lad will understand that it's not the same coming through the system and playing in the first team is going, getting bought and going to another club. Mm. You know, you just, it's hard to, and this, it's just football. You're probably taken for granted a little bit more when you've come through the system. Mm. You know, facts, you get paid less. They obviously, as a young kid coming through, the cards are all stacked in the club's favour because they've given you the opportunity, which is fair enough. That's, you know, but someone of your same ability could be brought into the football club and probably seen as more of a first team player, paid a lot more money, just seen differently.
Well, they've been sought after, haven't they?
And that's what happened when I went to Crystal Palace. It was like I'd went from being a young player with plenty of potential, played X amount of games in the Championship, come second in the Championship, got promotion with a very good team, played a handful of games in the Premier League, you know, being in England under 18 squad standby numerous occasions, never actually played. But and then all of a sudden, you know, I think I went to Crystal Palace for, I think the fee was, I think it ended up being close to £500,000. The initial fee I think was 250 in leading up to extras, and it just changed overnight. Like the dynamic of me in the dressing room being a player that had come from the Premier League, being a player that had been bought in, being a player, you know, and it was brilliant. It was a fantastic feeling, you know. As much as I love my time at Middlesbrough, then it was the going in there and being brought in and being wanted in a different type of way.
Yeah, yeah.
Not wanted. I couldn't say I was never wanted at Middlesbrough because, you know, they offered me a long term contract and I signed a long term contract. But the actual feeling of someone paying a big fee for you in going in there and being their number one left back, then it was fantastic. And, you know, in a 21, I think I was 2021, then it was you know, it was a big move because it was the opposite end of the country.
Exactly. I was just going to say, yeah.
You know, but again, I think that just sort of proved my determination that I wanted to play first team football, wherever that may be. I was a footballer and I wanted to play first team football.
And listening to you sort of describe your journey, it sounds like a bit of a whirlwind through your playing career, really. It's all just come so quickly, yeah. And you've had so many, you know, intoxicating memories, yeah, almost. Yeah. I mean, you've played with Gazza,
yeah.
He's a hero of yours, yeah. You've played with all these international, yeah. stars and local, yeah. local stars as well, yeah. And had some great managers.
Yeah.
And it came to quite a sad end, really. I mean,
it did, yeah, it did. You know, but I think, I don't know. Do you regret it? No. You know, it's one of them. The other thing as well is I was a favourite player. I was a favourite player, and the whole, you know, I probably not said this, and I might have said it, but you know, it could have quite easily been him than me. What happened? You know, it was a tenth of a second difference. The tackle that we both went in for, no bones about it. We both went in to hurt each other. And unfortunately, if that happens and you get it wrong, then it, you know, the consequences are catastrophic, and they were at the time. And you know, looking back now, I'm long past it now. You know, I've probably been comfortable with it for 3 or 4 years now, if not maybe a little bit longer. Definitely the first probably, I'd say the first probably 5 to 6 years was a real struggle. Certainly the first 18 months or 2 years was a massive struggle. You know, didn't have much to do with football. Obviously at the time, the injury happened. The long and short of it is the first actual operation wasn't successful. So I think I knew after that then, it's going to be a big struggle. You know, it's going to be a big struggle. It's something, it's a strange thing that I remember, like it was yesterday. I can't remember which national newspaper it was, but the day after it happened, there wasn't a big article, but there was a column saying about what had happened and that I'd never play again. And that was the day after it happened. I remember reading it in hospital bed after I just had the operation. You know, and that's something that you don't really want to see. But, you know, unfortunately, you know, that's what happens. The first operation, the actual operation, I think, went fine, but it was just not the rehab, it was just the way, the circumstances, because it was quite a complicated one. It wasn't a straightforward break, there you go, it'll heal. You know, there was metal rods, screws, all involved in it, and, you know, and bone graft and stuff like that, and it didn't actually go as well as what they would like it. So I think it was 6 or 7 months into it. I remember I was coming back and coming back and coming back, and I got to the point of where, you know, I got to the jogging stage, and I just remember thinking, I was only jogging 12 minutes at the time, and there was a real, real fiery pain on the front of my shin, like someone set it on fire. I was like, wow, this guy, you know, speak to the physio, speak to the doctor, understood that it'd been a horrendous injury. The trauma was almost like a road traffic accident trauma, excuse me. And so it was one of them that I just had to get on with it, but it got to a point after a week or so, and I was like, there's no way this is right, there's no way. We went for a second opinion, and then unfortunately what had happened is one of the bones had fused quicker than the other one, which caused a gap still. So basically I was jogging with a broken leg still. You know, it was fortunately I'd had the metal rod in, because if not, it wouldn't have happened. I would have just went over, and a bit in the break would have been horrendous again. So back to square one, had the whole operation again, had to break the other, had to break the fibia or tibia, take an inch or so out of it to stop it from growing, had to have a bone transfusion, bone graft, then a bigger nail put in, which was a ream nail, which brought it all together, more screws, knee and ankle screws, and all the way up my leg. And then I think from then on it was like, this is going to be an uphill battle now, because I'd already had, I think, I can't remember right now, but 6 to 8 months of real, you know, intense rehab and intense physio, and 8 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock at night. You know, people think, don't get me wrong, being a professional footballer is an absolute privilege, but, you know, it was the slog of that first bit, especially because the second half of my rehab after my second operation was probably not as intense, because I think, looking back, we all probably thought, this probably isn't going to go well here. I just think it was just because the first operation needed to be spot on, everything needed to be done properly, and needed to have a bit of luck, and everything needed to, you know, connect together to be right to play at the highest level again. You know, but it was just 8 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock at night, 3-4 sessions a day, you know, that for 8-9 months. then to go again and have the whole thing, you know, I was on crutches for 2 or 3 weeks after that, the whole operation again. So that's 10 months into it. Then there was another 9 months into rehabbing again. So altogether, I think we've done about 19, 20 months here. And I was actually training, not training with the group, but I was training by myself. I was running. I was physically fit. But I had a real problem because of the bone severed the skin and the tendon. So the bone come out the skin and the tendon. It was severing the tendon that runs through your big toe right the way to your kneecap. They had to sew that back together. So just naturally, that was shortened. My ankle lost about 26 to 30% flexibility and power. So it wasn't actually probably the broken leg that, because broken bones heal, you know, however long it takes, naturally they heal. But it was all the other trauma, the soft tissue trauma that went along with it, that in the end, like I think 19, 20 months in it, and I remember working really hard, and I got to probably the last month or so where I was back in with the squad, doing the warm-up, doing the non-contact drills, everything else, and it was just that last step, and I couldn't seem to get over that line. I couldn't get over the line, and I went to see the surgeon that done the second operation, and he just said, "Look, Craig, I don't think you're going to get there. I'll be blunt and honest with you. You know, I don't think you're going to get there through X, Y, and Z. Mainly the ankle, big toe on that foot." And it was just, you know, the power and the flexibility. I was probably 40% down with all in all. To play in an elite level again was probably just a step too far, which at the time, I think, was probably a relief more than anything else, because the nearly 2 years of rehabbing was an absolute nightmare. It was horrendous. You know, I must have been a nightmare to be any be part of my life at all at the time. You know, and it was just, like I said, it sounds terrible, but I think in the end I was 25 and they just turned, and it was just like almost relief. Just, I don't have to keep going through that again.
So you were happy to
say it? It sounds really, really strange. And I think for that, at that moment in time, it was, I wouldn't say happy, I'd say relief.
Yeah.
Because I just don't think I could keep going on with doing that again and again and again and again. You know, the not knowing, I've always said in my life, not knowing's worse than knowing either way. So if someone said to me, like, that was the feeling at the time, the not knowing was eating away at me on a daily basis, getting up, what's going to happen today, right, this, blah, 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 this, that, blah, right, okay, am I going to play again? Don't know. Right, next day, am I going to play? And when the surgeon said to me, you're not going to play, it was almost like, right, a weight off my shoulders. I'm not worrying about it every day. I know I'm not, but what I probably didn't do was I underestimated the journey I was going to have after that. You know, for a short period of time, it was relief and I was probably happy, but quite quickly, within a month or so, maybe a little bit more, the reality hit home of I'm never going to play football again, professionally again. And that's a whole different,
yeah.
You know, you're opening a whole different can of worms there in some deep and dark places.
And I mean, I met you a few years ago while you were at TNS and obviously got to know you quite well since. Yeah. And the one thing I could never imagine you saying is, I've had enough football. But that's how you felt at that time, from what I understand.
Yeah,
between you know, in that 5 or 6 years between management again. And
yeah, it was playing. Without a doubt. I've got no, you know, I had no intention, not 1% of my body wanted anything to do with football again. You know, it was just no. I didn't watch football. I spent a bit of time in Spain. I had some property out there, lived out there for a bit. Come back to England. Moved to Chester with my partner Danielle. We renovated houses, we sold them on, we moved around, and I had no interest whatsoever. I didn't even go watch a football game. I didn't even watch football on TV. I had nothing to do with it. It was, if we take a few 3 or 4 steps back to probably just long after, and obviously there's so much support now and there's so much high profile depression, you know, and obviously the sad situation with Gary Speed and all the other things, it's a lot more highlighted. There's a lot more help out there for professional sportsmen, sportswomen and general public with mental health issues than what there ever was when I was finishing there. And in I briefly spoke to the Crystal Palace doctor, who was fantastic. But apart from that, I sort of just bundled my way through it. You know, made some lot of poor decisions, probably hurt a lot of people along the way. But there was probably a 2 or 3 year period of where I was just sort of, I wouldn't be extreme to go off the rails, but it was just
not yourself.
Good. I think that would probably be an understatement. And it was just basically I lived and done what I wanted to do. And it wasn't particularly nice for everyone around us. You know, I was very recluse wise. You know, I remember one Christmas, it must have been the second or third Christmas after it happened. It was Christmas Day, and I stayed at home. Mum and Dad wanted us to come to their house. No, stayed at home, sat at home. I remember sitting watching TV, eating beans on toast, and just thinking, this is what I want. I don't want to be involved with anybody else. I'll do what I want to do, and I've got no problem with this. And, it was complete. And if you look at it now, there's so much help out there. You know, there's no doubt about it. I'd say it was quite severe depression, no doubt about it, looking back and looking what we know now and seeing what the, you know, what help's available. But I seem to get through with support from my family, friends, and sort of gradually got myself through it. Fortunately met Danielle, and we started a new life together, and I think probably it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. You know, that was, you know, move on, and football's was then. But 5-6 years later, it creeps up on you again. And talking about what I've talked about previously about that drug, when you're 18, 19, playing in the first team, and the adulation, and the, you know, and it just sort of creeps back towards you. And just when you think you're out, it grabs you and it drags you back in. And I think that's why there's so many managers out there. It's such a harsh job, and the landscape is so cruel to be, you know, 1 minute this, the next minute out of work. But if you get the opportunity again, you're back in. And I think everyone looks and goes, wow, you know. But if it's in you, it's in you. It's one of them things that you can't really do much about. It's, you know, it sucks you back in, and you're up and away again.
So Craig had quite a journey throughout his playing career, as you've just heard. It was a very difficult end to a promising playing career for the then 25-year-old Harrison, and although he fell out of love with the game for a long time, as he said at the end of the first part of this interview, football has a funny way of sucking you back into the mix. And that's where we're headed in part two, as we'll discuss Craig's outstanding managerial career so far. Be sure to join us for that tomorrow.